This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pahiskov.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى مقومًا ولا أذًى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Palestinians welcomed the International Criminal Court's decision to investigate Israeli war crimes. The US says it objects to the move. The Biden administration formally notifies Congress that it will remove Yemen's Ansar Allah movement from the US government's list of foreign terrorist organizations. Also ahead, thousands of people take to the streets in Myanmar's largest city, Yangon, to denounce the recent military coup. It's good to have you with us. Our top story, the International Criminal Court rules that the court has jurisdiction over the occupied Palestinian territories, paving the way for an investigation into Israeli war crimes. The ICC said its territorial jurisdiction in Palestine extends to the territories occupied by Israel since 1967, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry hailed the move, saying it's ready to cooperate with the court. The Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, described the decision as an important development, urging the court to investigate Israeli war crimes. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu denounced the ruling and called the court a political body. The US State Department said Washington objects to the move. Amnesty International said the court's decision marked a long overdue step towards justice for the victims.
The ruling opens the way for an investigation into crimes committed in the occupied Palestinian territories. These include allegations against Israel of war crimes, including settlement-related activities, and crimes against humanity, such as persecution, deportation, and transfer, as well as the crime of apartheid against Palestinian civilians in the West Bank.
Amnesty International said the perpetrators of war crimes and crimes against humanity have evaded justice for more than half a century. Back in 2019, ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda called for a full investigation into Israeli war crimes but asked the court to rule on the territory over which it has jurisdiction. Subsequently, she ruled that Palestine is a state and the ICC has jurisdiction involving its cases. Late last year, the US imposed sanctions against the court. Neither Israel nor the United States are members of the ICC, and both have vowed to prevent the court's probe into the allegations of crimes committed in the occupied Palestinian territories. Political commentator Bruce Katz says the ICC's ruling is a real game changer in the sense that it has overruled Israel's objections to an investigation into its war crimes.
I certainly think this is a game changer in the sense that Israeli objections to an investigation have no basis at this point. The court has overruled basically Israel's objections to an investigation, which is long overdue at any rate. As far as Washington, we need to remember that Trump is gone. Now, President Biden will face an interesting challenge here, because were he to disavow the ruling by the International Criminal Court, that would be, something that would harm his, or at least the perception of people, of different publics around the world, in terms of his presidency, the decision.
The United Nations has welcomed the U.S. plan to revoke its terrorist designation of four Yemen's Ansar Allah movement. The spokesman, Stefan Dujarric, says the move will help provide relief to millions of Yemenis in need of humanitarian assistance. The U.S. Secretary of State informally informed Congress about the decision to delist the Houthi movement. It says the decision follows a comprehensive review of the last-minute designation by the former U.S. administration. The department says the reversal is in response to Yemen's humanitarian crisis. Washington has also promised to halt its support for the Saudi and Emirati-led war on Yemen. The United Nations and humanitarian organizations had warned that the designation will push millions of Yemenis into a large-scale famine. Professor of Political Science Colin Cavell says the U.S. plan to reverse Yemen's Ansar Allah territory designation is just for political purposes.
If they cared about the people of Yemen, they would not say that they're still going to fight al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and they would stop altogether arming Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Arabian genocidal policy to exterminate the Yemeni people is the cause of this. So why does Biden say, well, we're going to make sure that we defend Saudi Arabia at all costs? What they're doing, this is for political purposes, and that is why they're saying they're going to pull out of Yemen. But they're not going to pull out of Yemen. They made very clear that they're going to continue to fight al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and they're going to use that pretext as a fight against the Houthis when they think it's in their interest. So the war is still a war of aggression by Saudi Arabia on the Yemeni people, and it is still supported by the United States and the United Kingdom, but this is a little pivot in patient trying to garner some international credence to say that things have changed.
The U.S. Treasury Secretary says the crisis caused by the coronavirus pandemic would have a lasting impact on African Americans unless action is taken. Janet Yellen made the remark in a virtual meeting she and Vice President Kamala Harris held with dozens of members of the National Black Chambers of Commerce. Yellen said economic crises hit people of color harder and longer. She stressed that during the early days of the pandemic, African Americans were the first to lose their jobs. The recession has hit women and minorities particularly hard, with businesses owned by African Americans closing at twice the rate of their white counterparts. Elsewhere, thousands of Myanmarese have taken to the streets in the largest city of Yangon to denounce a military coup that ousted the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. Protesters chanted slogans against what they called military dictatorship and demanded the army hand power back to the elected politicians. They also called for the release of Suu Kyi and other officials detained since Monday. The rally was the biggest street demonstration by the anti-coup campaign launched by students, teachers and workers. The coup and detentions followed escalating tensions between the government and the military over the last parliamentary election. Meanwhile, the United Nations has made its first contact with Myanmar's military since the coup, urging the junta to release the leaders. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has branded the coup as absolutely unacceptable. Pakistanis have held rallies to show support to the people of Kashmir. Meanwhile, Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has offered India talks to resolve the long-standing Kashmir dispute. Kamran Yusuf has more in this report.
People are marching on the streets to show support to the people of Kashmir. This rally in Islamabad is part of a series of events in Pakistan organized to mark the Kashmir Solidarity Day. Pakistan observes the day every year on the 5th of February. Pakistan's foreign minister led the rally in Islamabad and urged the international community to play a role in ending the suffering of the people of Kashmir.
The purpose of our today's rally is to express solidarity with the people of Kashmir. The people of Kashmir have been under siege for the last 18 months. But we want to make it clear that India cannot suppress the freedom of Kashmir forever.
Kashmir has remained under lockdown since August 5, 2019, when India revoked its special status. Thousands of people have been detained, and over 8 million Kashmiris have little access to the outside world.
We are thankful to the people of Pakistan and the government for supporting us. We are hopeful that Pakistan would continue to support us till Kashmir is liberated from India.
We must understand is the Kashmiris are living under an occupation and oppression for the past 73 years. And the 5th of February marks a day where we, the people of Pakistan particularly, tell the Kashmiris living across the line of control that they are not alone.
Pakistan and India have competing claims on the long-standing Jammu and Kashmir issue. Both claim the region in full but rule on parts of it. They have fought wars over Kashmir. Where tensions continue to increase, there is a fear of yet another conflict on the dispute between the two neighbors. The country's Prime Minister visited the Pakistani-administered Kashmir to mark the day.
Prime Minister Imran Khan says Pakistan is ready to take two steps forward if India is willing to seek a political settlement of the long-standing Kashmir dispute. However, given the current hostilities between the two neighbors, experts believe there is a slim chance of any dialogue on Kashmir, at least in the near future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Elsewhere, the United Nations Secretary General welcomes the formation of a new interim government in Libya.
I welcome the selection by members of the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum of a unified temporary executive authority. And I call on all members of the dialogue and the Libyan and international stakeholders to respect the results of the vote. It is essential that all foreign fighters and mercenaries move first to Tripoli and Benghazi and then leave the country according to the new schedule that was defined.
This comes after a UN-led forum voted on the interim government to run the war-torn country until general elections are held in December. Turkey, which has troops on the ground in Libya, also welcomed the formation of the interim government. The North African country plunged into chaos after the 2011 ouster of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Since then, the country has been ravaged by violence amid conflict between two seats of power based in the cities of Tripoli and Tobruk. A fragile ceasefire agreed in October has largely held. Now, Russia has expelled diplomats from Germany, Sweden and Poland for attending last month's protests in support of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. In a statement, the foreign ministry said that Moscow considers the actions of the diplomats unacceptable. Meanwhile, Sweden has reacted to the measure, calling it, quote, completely unfounded. Poland also has summoned the Russian ambassador over the decision, warning that Moscow's expulsion of a Polish diplomat would deepen the crisis in bilateral ties. In a joint virtual press conference, leaders of Germany and France have also denounced the expulsion of foreign diplomats by Moscow, with the German chancellor describing the move as unjustified.
During our meeting, we were informed of the expulsion of German, Swedish and Polish diplomats from Moscow in connection with demonstrations on Navalny. We consider this expulsion to be unjustified, and we believe this is a further step away from the rule of law noticeable in Russia right now.
With regards to the case of Navalny, I condemn very strongly, from its start to its end, what has happened. The poisoning, the terrible conditions of his return to Russia, the sanctions and the conviction, and today, the expulsion of German, Polish, and Swedish diplomats, which was decided by Russia.
The move by the Kremlin comes amid heightened tensions between Russia and Europe over Navalny's alleged poisoning and his recent imprisonment. He was arrested last month after returning from Germany, where he had been receiving treatment. His arrest then triggered unauthorized street protests in a number of cities. Russia has repeatedly said that Navalny's case is an internal affair and that it won't allow any foreign interference in it. Criticism by the EU over Russia's human rights record smacks of hypocrisy. That's according to some lawmakers in the 27-nation bloc. The subject has just been debated in the European Parliament. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
There are many EU legislators who depict Russia as a dangerous adversary that needs to be restrained. They condemn the imprisonment of opposition figure Alexei Navalny and the handling of protests in Russia.
The European Union needs to send a message by not only considering new sanctions, but also by increasing our support to prosecuted, tortured, and repressed voices of the opposition and the civil society.
It's rarely highlighted by mainstream media in the West that Navalny received a prison sentence last month after returning to Russia for breaking the terms of a 2014 suspended prison sentence. Also, Western media never mention the global pandemic when reporting on public protests in Russia organized by Navalny supporters. Just last weekend, 500 protesters were arrested here in Brussels, and those detained made claims of police brutality. Mainstream media vilify demonstrators here and in other Western nations for breaking COVID-19 rules, while at the same time portraying protesters in Russia as heroes. The EU and US accused the Russian government of poisoning Alexei Navalny last August. Navalny was treated in Germany after the alleged murder attempt. The Kremlin denies any role and is clearly unhappy that EU authorities refuse to provide medical evidence.
It is quite impolite, mildly speaking, and it is such arrogance from cultural Europe. It seems to me unacceptable and we categorically reject it.
There are many reasons why Brussels should try to improve relations with Moscow, some EU lawmakers insist.
Well, Russia is a capital neighbor. We cannot ignore that the longest neighbor, the longest border, it is with Russia. Russia is not only, an energy supplier. It's as well a strategic relation.
A good case in point, a number of EU nations are now scrambling to get their hands on Russia's Sputnik V COVID-19 vaccine, which is more than 90% efficacious. The EU has major vaccine supply issues. Moscow says it's happy to help. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Now, Turkish students and academics from Bazici University continue to protest the appointment of a new university rector by President That was always going to happen. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Hundreds have been arrested in protests that have been going on for over a month now. Erdogan has rejected European criticism over the arrests and says the protests are organized by opposition parties. Rashan Saglam reports from Istanbul.
Boğaziçi University continue protesting the appointment of AKP-affiliated rector. University academics turned their back to the newly appointed rector's office as a symbol of objection. The academics called for the resignation of Melih Bulu, the rector that was appointed by Turkish president. Protests have been going for weeks now, with police arresting hundreds. Demonstrations broke out early January, when Turkish president appointed Melih Bulu, an academic with strong ties with the ruling party, as the new rector for Boğaziçi University. Students and academics complained that the appointment broke a decade-long tradition of Boğaziçi rectors being elected from within the university academic team. The Boğaziçi crisis gathered support from other universities and oppositions, who saw in this new trial from the president to force control over the country after granting himself sweeping powers post-coup attempt in 2016. Erdogan said the protests are not led by students, claiming it is stamped by opposition parties.
A segment of politics is leading the way for this. It is not possible to describe and accept the protests as incidents about the university students. Turkey's opposition parties, including main opposition, Republican People's Party and E Party, as well as People's Democratic Party, are behind all of this.
Turkish president also slammed the US and France over their reaction to the protest, mentioning the incidents taking place ahead of US elections and calling French President Macron to take care of the Yellow Vest protests in his country before pointing fingers to what is happening in Turkey. Erdogan argued that the law grants the president the authority to appoint rectors and that he had done it before in other universities.
The whole issue broke out after president appointed the new rector. This is not against the law, but the problem is that Melibu isn't an academic and this is against the law. I disagree that the protests were driven by political parties. It started by students. Of course, opposition parties are taking advantage of the protests to lash out at the president.
The government response to the protest came harsh, as peaceful protests have been met with overwhelming violence and arrests. Critics and human rights activists say those are efforts by Erdogan to seize more power using the coup plot as a scarecrow. The Boğaziçi protest brings to mind the huge Gezi Park protest held years ago, with many saying that it will continue because the problem is in the system itself. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Brings an Intel bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
Two Atlanta, Georgia police officers who were fired after body cam footage showed them pulling two black college students from a car and using stun guns on them during last summer's protests have gotten their jobs back. We now present you a news report in this regard written by Kate Brumback. The piece is titled Firings of U.S. Officers After Students Pulled from Car Reversed. The article has been published by abcnews.com website. Video of Atlanta police officers using tasers and pulling two college students from a car during a large protest last year against police brutality and racial injustice sparked national outrage, and two of the police officers involved were immediately fired. Recently, though, their dismissals have been overturned. The Civil Service Board found the city did not follow its own personnel procedures, which resulted in the police officers being deprived of due process because they were not given proper notification or adequate opportunity to respond. The board, which is made up of five residents recommended by the mayor and confirmed by the city council, ordered recently that the dismissals of Ivory Streeter and Mark Gardner be revoked. Police officers confronted Messiah Young and Tania Pilgrim, rising seniors at historically black colleges in Atlanta, Georgia, as they were struck in traffic after a curfew declared by the mayor on 30th of May 2020 during protests sparked by the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Police body camera footage shows police officers shouting at the couple, firing taser guns at them and dragging them from the car. Throughout the confrontation, the pair can be heard screaming and asking what they did wrong. Video of the confrontation was shared widely online, and Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms and then Police Chief Erica Shields decided the two police officers had used excessive force and must be fired immediately. Ivory Streeter and Mark Gardner each received a notice of proposed adverse action on 31st of May 2020, indicating dismissal effective the following day and citing maltreatment or unnecessary force. That same day, they were served notices of final adverse action effective the next day. The Civil Service Board said in its order, generally an employee should be given 10 days between the notice of proposed adverse action, such as firing, and its effective date. An adverse action can become effective immediately in an emergency situation, but the board found the City of Atlanta did not follow its own guidelines for an emergency situation. Shields, who stepped down as police chief in Atlanta about 2 weeks after the incident, told the board extraordinary circumstances resulted in the decision to fire the two longtime police officers. City officials feared the incident would increase outrage against police. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Shields testified, The circumstances were exceptional, adding, I did what I had to do to make sure the city was stabilized. Atlanta's mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, on Tuesday, 2nd of February, noted that the Civil Service Board did not say the police officer's conduct was lawful. She said in an email statement, given the unrest across our city and nation at the time and the disturbing video footage before us, I still believe that the right decision was made. Reverend James Woodall, state president of the Georgia National Association for Advancement of Colored Persons, said the mayor didn't do enough to work with community leaders to address an unfolding crisis in the city of Atlanta. He wrote in a text message recently, "Unfortunately, we are seeing the continued failure of Atlanta's mayor and the newly appointed DNC vice chair, Keisha Lance Bottoms, to address the systematic failure of extrajudicial violence against black Atlantans." He added, "Our streets are less safer now that these two police officers are back on the streets." The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reports that the two police officers can now return to their old jobs but could face an internal investigation. It wasn't immediately clear when or whether the police officers would return to their jobs with the department. They also still face criminal charges that the Fulton County District Attorney at the time, Paul Howard, announced just a couple of days after the incident. Arrest warrants say Ivory Streeter was charged with aggravated assault for using a taser against Young and with pointing a gun at him. A warrant says Mark Gardner was charged with aggravated assault for using a taser against Pilgrim. Four other police officers were also charged. In an email to the department after Howard's announcement, Shields defended the firing of the police officers but questioned the timing and appropriateness of the charges. Newly elected Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis, who ousted Howard, asked Georgia Attorney General Chris Carr recently to assign the case to another prosecutor, saying actions by Howard make it inappropriate for her office to pursue the case. It will be up to a new prosecutor to decide whether to proceed with the charges. Attorney L. Chris Stewart, who represents Pilgrim, told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution he was disappointed by the idea of the police officers returning to their jobs. He said, "The video speaks for itself." Attorney Mawuli Davis, who represents Young, said his client was stunned and saddened to learn that the police officers' firings had been reversed. Lance LaRusso, a lawyer for the police officers, told the newspaper the firings resulted from a rush to judgment and said his clients are eager to return to work. Bottoms claimed this incident and others led to charges in the city's use of force policy, including de-escalation training and guidance on when and how to intervene in specific situations. The mayor of Atlanta, Keisha Lance Bottoms, said, "It is my sincere hope that these policy changes and additional training for our police officers will help eliminate the potentially life-threatening and deadly encounters that have happened in the past." Meanwhile, in another incident, a 9-year-old black girl has been handcuffed and pepper-sprayed by U.S. police in the city of Rochester, New York, sparking fresh outrage and anger over excessive use of force by police officers. A minute-long body cam video shows police called to the scene and responded by handcuffing the 9-year-old black girl before trying to force her into the car and pepper-spraying her when she resisted. Rochester Deputy Police Chief Andre Anderson said on Sunday, 31st of January, the minor had been suffering from a serious mental health emergency, claiming the girl was suicidal and threatened to kill her mother. The police violence has sparked anger and reactions from officials. The mayor of Rochester, Lovely Warren condemned the use of force against a 9-year-old child and said she was deeply troubled by the incident. She pledged an internal review of the city's law enforcement practices. She said at a press conference on Sunday, 31st of January, "It is clear from the video that we need to do more supporting our children and our families," adding, "I have a 10-year-old child, so she's a child, she's a baby. This video, as a mother, is not anything you want to see." Damond Meeks, member of the New York State Assembly, tweeted that the police officers involved should be fired for their conduct. Council member Mary Lupien also tweeted, "Having been pepper sprayed, I can attest that this incident will change her life. There will be accountability for this." U.S. police violence against African Americans, including the killing of George Floyd in May of 2020, set off nationwide protests across the United States against racial injustice and police brutality. The latest incident is the second time in a year that Rochester has come under national scrutiny for police violence against African Americans following the killing of Daniel Prude last March. The death of Daniel Prude, who was undergoing a mental health crisis at the time of his detention, prompted a grand jury probe and sparked mass protests in the United States.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خان که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبری.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. European News Bulletin.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Saeed Pourreza. Our top story this hour. The Iranian Foreign Ministry has blasted the 20-year jail term issued by Belgian courts to an Iranian diplomat over a supposed bomb plot against a terrorist organization, Mojahedin Khalq. The court alleged a diplomat, Asadullah Asadi, had plotted a bomb attack against an MKO gathering in Paris in 2018. Iran has condemned the conviction and sentencing as illegal and unjustifiable and accused the Belgian courts of being influenced by the anti-Iran terrorist group. Mojahedin Khalq organization, established in the 1960s, has conducted thousands of assassinations and bombings against Iranian officials and civilians since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. For more on that story, I'm joined by Professor Mohammad Mirandi of the University of Tehran's Institute for North American and European Studies. It's good to have you with us, Dr. Mirandi. It's been a while. I guess we can begin with your reaction to this sentencing in Belgium.
Well, thank you for having me. And I think it's pretty clear that for Iranians, the Mujahideen Khalq organization is a terrorist organization. It has murdered more Iranians than Al-Qaeda has Americans. In other words, on 9/11, 2001, roughly 3,000 Americans were killed by Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda and in New York and in the United States, whereas the Mujahideen Khalq terrorist organization, which is a cult, they've killed up to 17,000 Iranians, and that is not including their activities that they carried out as a part of Saddam Hussein's army, because they went to Iraq and fought alongside Saddam Hussein against their own country. So, and we have to also compare the populations of the United States and Iran. So when we look at it from that perspective, the number of Iranians that these people have murdered through bomb attacks, as you pointed out, and terror attacks and suicide attacks are extremely high. I have my own experiences, and many people my age or older or somewhat younger have personal experiences in Tehran, near my own home. A bomb exploded, killing an Armenian family of four alongside, I think, seven other people on the streets as people were going to work in the morning. That's exactly what they used to do. They used to carry out attacks on ordinary people just to create fear and terror. What they did in Tehran was not dissimilar to what the Saudi and Turkish-backed ISIS would do in Iraq or in Syria.
Right. Well, their record is clear, isn't it? They were on the U.S. terror list for many years before they were taken off of it. How does a terrorist group, a cult, go to court and win a case like that? Is this perhaps all aimed at detracting from the fact that they are a terrorist organization?
Well, Europeans in the United States, European governments in the United States, use terrorism to achieve their strategic objectives. The French government allowed them to work in France during the 1980s. And the United States, even during the period when they formally considered the MEK a terrorist organization, they allowed it to work in the United States under a different name. Or different names.
Right.
So while the MEK was carrying out terrorist attacks in Iran, and while it was fighting alongside Saddam Hussein against Iranians, they had offices throughout Europe, and they were funded by the Europeans and Americans and other regimes that saw them as a useful ally. And right now they have a major camp, a very big camp in Albania. Mm-hmm. Thousands of their troops are based there, and at the moment, one of the things that they do is that they act as a cyber army. And of course, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram allow them to use tens of thousands of different accounts to carry out psychological warfare against Iran. And they also work alongside the Israeli regime for intelligence gathering, alongside the Americans to gather intelligence inside. From inside the country, and also to carry out terrorism.
And their annual gatherings have seen keynote speakers such as former National Security Advisor John Bolton, Trump's personal lawyer Rudy Giuliani, the former Canadian president, and many other people. What do you say to those people who think that this whole thing, this ruling in Belgium, is politically motivated? Briefly.
Well, I don't know the details of the case, and for me, it's completely irrelevant. Of course, this was a diplomat, and if he could have been framed, I have no idea about the details. But for me, the issue is that they're harboring terrorists. They are harboring people who killed Iranians, many thousands of Iranians. And if it was Iran that was doing this, the Europeans and Americans would probably be advocating war against Iran or airstrikes against the country. So the Europeans can destroy countries like Libya, they can impose starvation and sanctions on Yemen or Venezuela, they can carry out a dirty war in Syria. When they can do all those things, they can also support terrorist organizations that originate from Iran.
Professor Marandi in Tehran, pleasure talking to you. Thanks. to Russia now. The country has today expelled EU diplomats from Germany, Poland, and Sweden after accusing them of attending illegal rallies in support of jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny. All the officials have been ordered to leave the territory of the Russian Federation as soon as possible. The announcement comes just hours after EU Foreign Affairs Chief Josep Borrell met Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Moscow to discuss the 2.5-year prison sentencing of Navalny. Russia has previously lambasted Western nations for their, quote, interference on Russia's own domestic affairs in the case of Alexei Navalny. U.S. President Joe Biden is set to announce an end to U.S. support for the grueling 5-year Saudi-led military offensive on Yemen that's been dubbed the worst man-made humanitarian disaster. Yemen is the poorest country in the Arabian Peninsula and has been under intense Saudi blockade and bombardment. The move would fulfill a campaign pledge by Biden, whose administration plans to pursue diplomacy to end the overall conflict in Yemen after years of both Obama and Trump administrations supporting the Saudi-led bombing campaign. Biden now claims he sees the United States playing a more active and engaged role to end the war through talks. COVID-19 is also ravaging the Yemeni population, which is facing famine and starvation.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
All right, let's get more on that story and bring you some tweets as well. Robert Anakesh joins me now with all of that. And Robert, Biden trying to put an end to a war that he and Barack Obama, when they were in power together, helped start. This cannot be a genuine move.
No, and a lot of people have observed after actually having watched the speech that Joe Biden did not announce that he is going to end the war on Yemen. In fact, what he did say is that he would stop supporting Saudi's offensive action. Now, we know that the United States has been taking more of a harsh line towards the Saudis, but this, I would argue, and many others have argued, is done strategically in order to push Saudi in the direction that they want them to go. But when we look at what he actually said in the speech, he said that they would not support offensive action, but they would support Saudi's defensive action, and that relevant arms sales would be canceled, but they would still sell weapons to Saudi Arabia. Of course, Saudi Arabia is the top weapons purchaser from the United States, and that doesn't seem to be changing. So for those thinking that the United States will stop supporting the war, it's completely inaccurate how it's being reported on the mainstream press. They will support defensive action, and we know the doctrine of the United States when it comes to defensive action is one where it's a very blurred line between defense and offense. You're allowed to do preemptive strikes, for instance. We see this with Israel all the time. Israel claims always that it's acting in a defensive manner when that's not the case. And the Saudis would claim this too. They would claim that they're supporting the internationally recognized Hadi forces and that they're defending the rights of Yemen and they're defending Saudi Arabia. They would never say openly that they are committing offensive action in order to kill civilians, which is what they're doing. So when it comes to Biden's words, we see from what he actually said in real context that they are not stopping their support for the war on Yemen at all. The number one thing he can do at this point is to take Ansarullah or the Houthis off of the designated terrorist lists so that at least aid could come in and it will stop the blocking of aid to crucial areas inside of Yemen,
where millions of people are facing starvation. Tell us what Twitter users have been saying about this story.
The first one that we pulled up here is from a user called Syrian Girl. She says, Biden didn't pull troops out of Yemen. There was no U.S. troops in Yemen. He is simply saying the U.S. is no longer going to back Saudi Arabia's offensive operations. So now the starvation of Yemeni children will be labeled as defensive operations. We have another one here as well from a different user who says that the Saudi crooks should be held to account. The Yemeni people suffered because of their actions, and the day will come when their own people will rid of these crooks.
All right, Robert and Lakesh. Robert, thanks. And now to other news. French President Emmanuel Macron has criticized social media networks for restricting former U.S. President Donald Trump's access to their platforms at the end of his presidency.
Unique way to preserve our democracies is to reestablish a public and democratic order in this new space where our people think, live, and more because of the pandemic as well, I have to say. And this new regulation, this new governance, in a certain way, has to be democratic and discussed between our leaders. And I think this is very important. And for me, this is one of the critical challenges of our times.
Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter silenced former U.S. President Donald Trump during his last days in power after his supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol in a violent insurrection on January 6th. Twitter permanently shut down Trump's account, Real Donald Trump, which had 89 million followers. UN Chief Antonio Guterres has once again called on the Israeli regime to stop its illegal settlement activity on Palestinian land and further support the distribution of coronavirus vaccines on occupied land.
The special coordinator continues to encourage Israel to help address the priority needs of Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory and to support COVID-19 vaccine availability more generally, which is in line with Israel's obligations under international law.
Addressing a Palestine-focused panel, Guterres expressed his support for the upcoming Palestinian presidential and legislative elections and reiterated that votes in the illegally occupied Jerusalem outwards must be included in the elections. More than a month into the UK's third lockdown, and many rough sleepers have not been housed. During the first lockdown, at least 29,000 people were given shelter and food so they could self-isolate. That was during the first few months of the pandemic. The scheme quietly ended in May, and it has not been revived, despite the winter months and the UK's toughest weeks battling the virus. Bianca Rahimi has more in this report.
Every winter, there is a spike in avoidable deaths among rough sleepers as temperatures plummet. This year could be catastrophic, with more people sleeping rough than ever before. There was a 21% increase in rough sleeping in London in 2020. More than 70,000 households have been made homeless since the start of the pandemic, and young people make up 11% of that figure, which is an historic high. There was a staggering 118% increase in new referrals of young people from April to August 2020, compared with the same period the year before. The reasons being unemployment, rent arrears, financial instability, and evictions. Before the pandemic hit, the British government made an election manifesto commitment to end rough sleeping by May 2024. But the Everyone In campaign the government's communities, housing, and local government department launched after the pandemic first hit, immediately housing nearly 30,000 people, has proven the problem can be solved much sooner if the will is there.
So many homeless people you see on the streets all the time, more than ever. And it doesn't seem to be a priority at the moment.
You can see people all over the place. There's a man outside Tesco's, wrapped up in his little blanket, fast asleep. He's got nowhere else to go. We've got people camping out down there. And if people, sometimes their tents and everything else are destroyed or burnt. They've got nowhere to go, except in gutters, doorways, and around back alleys. The government are doing nothing.
The kind of budget deficit is probably in the red, and the total kind of government expenditure is extremely high. I think it's probably a very tough time for people to be spending, you know, for the government to keep handing out money in certain circumstances when it's the taxpayer paying for it. It's a certain situation. It's tough, and there's obviously homelessness is a massive issue. And I think all homeless people should be offered kind of shelter and things like that. I think that's really important.
What happens at night? I'll just go back to my tent.
So you sleep in a tent? You don't go to a shelter. Why don't you go to a shelter?
Because St. Mungo's supposed to come and help me, but they didn't. And someone said about putting me on Streetlink. Streetlink didn't come out either.
In a UK first, homeless people have been made a priority for the COVID-19 jab after Oldham Council in Manchester took matters into its own hands and vaccinated its rough sleepers alongside those over 80. With the new variant of COVID-19, which spreads much easier, and the cold weather setting in, anyone without a home is in a very precarious situation. Rough sleepers have an average lifespan of only 45 years, so they must be made a priority. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Covering two stories that have been trending on Twitter in this segment. First off, the case of Kyle Rittenhouse, the teenager accused of fatally shooting two men and wounding a third during protests over the killing of a black man named Jacob Blake, if you recall, shot seven times in the back by a white police officer. And this all happened in August last year. Months later, where is Kyle Rittenhouse? Well, let's bring in Richard Sudan with that story and all the details. Richard.
I think you've hit the nail on the head with your introduction, Saeed, and always good to talk to you. Yes, indeed, Kyle Rittenhouse, the man who shot and killed two people at a Black Lives Matter protest in Kenosha in Wisconsin, is walking free. He's at an undisclosed location, and because of this, the prosecutorial services have issued a fresh arrest warrant. But in many ways, the question really is, how did Kyle Rittenhouse post bail in the first place? It raises all sorts of questions about the legitimacy of the United States to call itself a fair democracy. But I suppose in many ways, Saeed, America is at least living up to its reputation as the land of the free, in the sense that Kyle Rittenhouse is walking free, Breonna Taylor's killers are walking free, Trayvon Martin's killer, George Zimmerman, is walking free, Eric Garner's killer is walking free, and the man who killed Mike Brown in Ferguson, police officer Darren Wilson, is also walking free. So in many ways, the wider issue is also about restorative justice in the United States, questions about reparations, and also disparities in terms of policing, the prison system, education, healthcare, and so on. But, you know, you and I could discuss this, Saeed, and there are literally hundreds of examples, and I mean hundreds of examples, where it's arguable that the killers, you know, and the victims are not going to receive justice, and, you know, people that carry out these grave travesties of justice walk free again and again and again.
And also, Richard, a question about the fact that cash bail, to put it that way, the fact that this young man has been able to accumulate that kind of money in order to be able to post bail and walk free and then disappear.
Well, just on that point, remember the killer of George Floyd, Derek Chauvin, initially posted bail too. And I think that was around $1 million. Again, where did he get the money from? Of course, Derek Chauvin, I think, has since been arrested and been charged. And he's facing trial, I think, in March. But again, it begs the question, how on earth do these people walk free in the first place? And of course, not many people are really expecting this situation to change under Joe Biden. Even if there was a radical platform and agenda of change on the table, which there really isn't, because let's not forget, Joe Biden has broken his promise to take immediate action on policing and mass incarceration. So all of these issues really feed into the headline that we looked at regarding Kyle Rittenhouse. Sure. And I think a lot of people are really making the connections here, Saeed. There's a much wider context.
The voices of
this
some
story.
Of those people, Richard.
Absolutely. Let's go first to a tweet from Tariq Nasheed, who says, "So killer Kyle Rittenhouse was released on bail after killing two people, allowed to hang out at a bar with the white supremacist terrorist group, the Proud Boys. Now the prosecutors can't find him. The privilege is coming down like an avalanche of mayonnaise with this story." And C. Fishy tweets, "Jacob Blake was shot seven times in the back and is paralyzed. Kyle Rittenhouse murdered two people with a weapon he was carrying illegally and gets to bar hop with his mum and feels free to violate his parole. And if we've got time for one more, let's go to Sharinsky, who simply says, Kyle Rittenhouse is free. Most of the ones who stormed the Capitol are free. Just a reminder, many of the white supremacists who stormed the Capitol in the US on January the 6th are, lo and behold, also free.
And Richard, while we're in the United States, tell us what's been happening with the former president, Donald Trump, the man who was behind a lot of what we've been talking about over the past 4 years here.
Well, shocking for a headline here, Saeed. I hope you're sitting down. Donald Trump rejects a request for testimony in the Senate impeachment trial. In many ways, this was predictable. It doesn't really tell us anything new about Donald Trump because, of course, many would argue Donald Trump has basically trampled all over any semblance of a true democratic process at every single juncture. Of course, Donald Trump actually may well still face a number of court cases and subpoenas, but of course, you know, he's standing to be impeached twice.
Richard, I think right now is, will the impeachment managers, the Democrats, be able to require him to actually appear and testify under oath?
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question, and it really depends on which kind of legal expert you consult on the issue. But what we can be absolutely sure about, with no doubt, I think we can safely say, is that Donald Trump is going to do everything within his power to really avoid any true sense of accountability, as he's done throughout his premiership when he was president, and others would say,
He still seems to have a lot of support in his Republican Party, Richard. Last thing that came out, Marjorie Taylor Greene was also facing all kinds of charges herself. The far-right Republican politician has said today that Trump owns the Republican Party. So a lot is going to happen as we move forward, and I'm sure you're going to bring it all to us. But let's hear some online voices on this.
And there's a lot of them. Father of Two says, I remember Trump saying people that refuse to testify or take the fifth are guilty. Peter Windhorst says, Trump refuses to testify the accused and will not appear at trial. We have two choices. One, subpoena him to appear to be arrested. Two, run the trial without him. And since he won't appear in court, ladies and gentle people, he is guilty of all charges. And Deep Thought tweeted, twice impeached President Chicken. I mean, Trump is afraid to testify on his own defense. Only guilty people refuse to testify.